My name is Kurt Allen. I'm president and CEO of the Mississippi Aquarium.
And I'm Alexa DeLon. I'm the vice president of veterinary services and research here at the aquarium.
Hello, I'm John Rossi. I'm a touring drummer with a passion for animal conservation. When I'm on the road, I spend as much time as possible visiting zoos, aquariums, and conservation organizations. Now, I want to share those places with you. I'll be talking to keepers, vets, conservationists, anyone who can help me in my mission of connecting my people to animals through their people. Join me on my raw safari. Hello, 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 and welcome back to the Raw Safari Podcast. All right, y'all, so this episode is, one that I owe to a friend of mine who's not in the industry, or at least not in the zoo industry, in my other industry, yes. So those of you who have been following along for a while know that I wrote and lead my own show that I tour around with from time to time called Under the Sun. And we recently did a small southern tour of the show. And I run basically everything with that show. So when we got booked to have a couple of different dates in towns I'd never heard of before, I didn't even think to look into anything for the podcast. I was very focused on the gigs and on leading all of that and making sure that everything would be good. So imagine my surprise when just a couple of nights before we headed down to our first stop in Gulfport, Mississippi, my buddy Jason, who plays bass and some guitar and also sings in Under the Sun, he's also the piano player and lead vocalist in the Great Balls of Fire show that I tour with a lot, and we've also done a bunch of Million Dollar Quartets together. Anyway, Jason sent me a message and was like, "Hey, are you going to check out this aquarium in Gulfport?" And yes, Jason, I was, since this is past tense now. I hadn't thought that there was anything there. I didn't think to look. I frankly, you know, looking back on it, don't know what was wrong with me. That's kind of the whole thing that I do with this podcast. But I reached out and they were immediately willing to accommodate me. And so I got down to Gulfport and we did our walkthrough of the venue the first night. And then the next day I had sound check at like 3 o'clock and I spent the entire morning and early afternoon at the Mississippi Aquarium. And it was a really amazing time. It's a newer facility. It's a beautiful facility. And this episode is one of those fun ones where I'm interviewing two people. And honestly, it felt like it went by so fast in the moment. And then when I was editing the interview, the same thing happened. I heard myself say, "We're running out of time." And I was like, "Wait, aren't we like 20 minutes in?" I actually looked up at the time clock for the episode, thinking I had done something wrong and like missed a bunch of stuff. I don't know why. I guess it was just fun and interesting. But I think y'all are really gonna enjoy this one. And I love that I almost missed this opportunity. And then one of my friends was just able to be like, "Hey, John, are you going to this?" And I'm so grateful to Jason for doing that. So thanks, buddy. So before we get to the interview, a quick reminder to make sure you hit subscribe, make sure that you're following along on socials at Raw Safari, on TikTok at Raw Safari Pod. And hey, don't forget that you can support the podcast on Patreon for as little as $3 a month by going to patreon.com/rawsafari. You get some cool stuff when you do that, including bonus audio from some episodes, including this one. So that's exciting for my patrons, and you could become one of them too. Just saying. Also, don't forget that I am hosting a contest online right now where you can win some really cool stuff, including the Peppermint Narwhal Animal Holidays Calendar for 2024. We've got a few different copies of those to send out to some winners. And the LE Artisan Studio Penguin sweatshirt, the Penguins of the World sweatshirt, that she was just doing a big contest with Penguins International for, and there was one winner, but now you can become a winner as well. And the best part is, You can do that by supporting my my fundraiser for the Lehigh Valley Zoo Red Panda exhibit, which there are links up for in my socials. But also you can do it without spending any money by reading and reviewing the podcast on a variety of places. So go ahead and check my socials, my stories, especially on Instagram and Facebook for all of the details there. And go ahead and get yourself some entries. There will be more prizes being announced soon. So exciting times. All right. Without further ado, here is my interview with Kurt Allen and Dr. Alexa DeLon of the Mississippi Aquarium.
Cool. All right. And you said DeLon?
DeLon.
Awesome. I was having a lot of fun trying to figure out how to say that name. I was talking to my wife, Zoe, and I was like, cool, I'm going to be talking to Alexa DeLon. I'm going to be talking to their vet.
I married into that name, and my husband always says, pronounce it like Mo DeLon, like you're rowing.
I love that. Mo DeLon. That's great. My my wife really debated changing her last name because, you know, she has papers published under her maiden name.
Yeah,
and everything.
Same.
But her last name was Vesely-Gross.
Oh.
And she has an umlaut over the E. So in her entire life, in the Zoe part, her name is Zoe. I forget if I said that. But she can almost never put anything in a computer properly.
Yeah.
It either won't take the hyphen or it won't take the umlaut. And so she was like, all right, at least I can get rid of one of these.
Yeah.
I'm taking your stupid name, but this isn't any patriarchal crap. Like, okay. But anyway, moving on. So we're here at the Mississippi Aquarium, and you mentioned that it's 3 years old. And I vaguely remember 3 years ago, and there was this slight little thing that happened, COVID, I think.
Yeah.
What impact did that have trying to open a new facility?
Yeah, it was really interesting because construction started before COVID, and really the construction phase, we had the money. Most of the money was public money. It was either federal, state, local, city money. And so the money was kind of sitting in the bank. And as construction was going on and COVID hit, it was like, what do you do? Construction was deemed a necessary business. And so construction could continue. And so we had to figure out ways to continue construction to try to get open. At the same time, every business was trying to shut down
right. And
save money. And so it was this dichotomy of what we were trying to accomplish versus everybody else. And it really affected construction, trying to get retail products because nobody in China was making retail products that were getting shipped to the country. The supply chain issues because nobody was working. The ports were backed up. So it was hard to try to keep moving because subcontractors were shutting down their small businesses because they all were getting COVID. And so it took a lot of planning. And then eventually you start running out of money. And so you have to make a decision whether you're going to open or not. And as we were trying to open, we had animals on hold all across the country at other institutions. And all these other institutions are shutting down. And so how do you get your animals in? How do you get them quarantined? How do you get them acclimated? And so it was a real chore through that time because COVID hit in February and we opened in August, and that was the worst part of it. So it was hard.
Yeah, I bet. I can't even imagine. I know, you know, my industry obviously shut down entirely, and I just can't imagine trying to open a big public, mostly indoor, although y'all do have a lot of great outdoor exhibits here, facility in the middle of a pandemic.
the outdoor really helped us, actually. And I will go back and say we were extremely fortunate to be in the state we were in. Our governor, and his view of how to continue doing business was a lot different than other states. If we were in California, Monterey Bay Aquarium closed for 15 months.
Right.
If we were in California or New York, where they put much harsher restrictions, I don't know. I honestly don't know what we would have done. But because we are in a state that looked at it differently and tried to open businesses, we were able to continue doing what we were doing. So it really goes back to some of the leadership in the state to say, all right, they came out and said, we are here to protect the lives of Mississippians, but we're also here to protect the livelihoods of Mississippians. And they knew the importance of trying to continue the economics of the state. And so we were fortunate enough to be able to do that as we did. So, like I said, it was a tough time. And I forgot where I was going with that, but
I mean, it was a tough time.
But it was a tough time, and it was because of the regulations. Oh, and being outside, you know, and people would say, well, how many people can you have on campus, you know? And when you're outside and social distancing was there, you know, you start doing calculations on, all right, we've got 6 acres and this much inside, this much outside. Oh, we can have 4,000 people on property, whatever it was. And being outside, it was, you can police yourself outside. And at the time, you know, we were policing kind of inside. So it did help us that we weren't all in one building and trying to condense a whole lot of people. And we could let people spread out a little bit. As you saw on the campus, we're a little bit spread out with those outdoor exhibits.
Yeah, it's gorgeous, by the way. I think I love, you know, I love zoos. I love aquariums. I love new facilities and new exhibits at both. But boy, there is something about a newer aquarium. I love all my old aquariums that I've been to. I do. But it's just, there's so much more in the construction now, and there's so much cool stuff. And this place really takes advantage of that. I can tell the walkthrough was amazing.
Yeah. The, you know, the planning started back in 16 and 17, and the architects, the exhibit architects was PGAV out of St. Louis. And, you know, they wanted to make a statement, and we're still considered in the rebuilding of Katrina. You know, we opened on the 15th anniversary of Katrina so that we could kind of remember the past, but really showcase how the coast has come 15 years later. And you now have a world-class aquarium in Gulfport, Mississippi, that most Mississippians never thought could happen. And we really wanted to make a statement. And I think we did that by, I always say we're kind of the cherry on the top of everything that's kind of transpired along the coast over the last 15 or now 18 years. But we're a showcase. And that really was the vision of the people that started the project, was let's put something first-class, world-class, and use that as a stimulus for economic development and really start to get some more projects moving along the coast to continually redevelop.
That's awesome. I really like that. And it brings up a great question, though. You are on the coast. what do you have to, you know, what extra thoughts have to go into that with the fact that hurricanes happen? And I'm sure there was one or two extra considerations.
Yeah. And in a little quick history, there was a marine facility here before Katrina across the street from our current location that pretty much got wiped out during the hurricane. And it was a facility that had been here for many, many years, and people along the coast grew up with it. So they grew up with seeing dolphins and sea lions and all these other things. So there was this innate feeling to bring that back. And that's kind of why the aquarium was brought back, as well as the economic stimulus and everything else. But yeah, so when we knew what the destruction was like after Hurricane Katrina, and so the design factors that we built into the facility, for instance, the property that we sit on, the Katrina floodwaters came up about 24 and a half feet above sea level. Our base elevation where our buildings sit is at 25. And so we picked that elevation because that's what Katrina floodwaters were, and we wanted to go up. And it's built with the highest standards for winds. We really don't have flooding. If we have flooding issues, we don't have a lot of things that are critical mass that could get flooded out. We've got a flood wall that surrounds the facility that helps protect it. We've got massive pumps that can help pump water out of our life support systems. So we've done all the preparation we can for another storm. And we always are looking at the weather with a storm right now for everyone out there. And, you know, the tracks, I looked this morning, it looks like it's turning north before it gets to the coast. But we always look. And trying to open the facility, going back to how hard it was to open a facility, we planned a whole week of soft opening events for our sponsors and kind of neighbors. We opened, and that was we started on a Sunday, and we had city employees kind of come with their families because we needed to learn how to run an aquarium, not just build it. Now all of a sudden you got to operate it. So we had one day where we let people in and walk around and look at everything and kind of watch people. And the next day we closed down for 4 days because of a hurricane. And so we had to get through a hurricane. We did our first hurricane prep before we opened, 4 days before we opened. Then we had to get back into the operation mode and have a ribbon cutting with VIPs and have the governor here to open the door. 2 days before the governor was here, we're still, you know, trying to figure out how to clean up after hurricanes. So it is something we think about all the time. Every storm season, we have preparations, and we've got a pretty seasoned team to be able to react quickly, and we're pretty good at it.
Awesome. That's very cool. Cool. So normally when I start these, there was just too much interesting stuff right away, but I kind of like to get a background of the people that I'm talking to. So where do y'all come from as far as, like, you know, literally from when you first thought, hey, maybe I like animals, to getting to the Mississippi Aquarium?
Okay. Well, I'm originally from Kansas.
Okay. You are not in Kansas anymore.
Yep.
This is the level of seriousness I have in my podcast. You're welcome.
You know what? All my life I've had those jokes, and now Amazon made the Alexa, and so now it's shifted to that. So whatever, I can't get away from it. No, so I grew up in Kansas and obviously away from the ocean. But when I was 8 years old, we went to see, we went to an amusement park that happened to have a dolphin show. And it was the first time I had seen a dolphin or anything else that lived in the ocean. And I was instantly fascinated and thought I wanted to be a marine biologist. And not only did I think that, that's from the age of 8 until I was an adult, that's what my focus was. Okay. So I went to undergrad at the University of Kansas because I got a scholarship there. And then after that, I moved to Florida and I studied sea turtles at Florida Atlantic University.
Nice.
With some very, very good sea turtle biologists named Dr. Jeanette Leineken and Dr. Mike Salmon. And then I was very unfortunate in that my study site got destroyed by 3 hurricanes in one season. So I was studying the way juvenile sea turtles move and navigate, but the reef that they were on got wiped out. So I was about 25 years old at that time, and it's all I'd ever wanted to do. So I was pretty disappointed and trying to think of what else I could do because my research projects just kept failing for things out of my control. So I decided maybe I could apply to vet school and become an aquatic animal vet. And I was very naive because I had no idea how hard it was to get into vet school, let alone become an aquatic animal vet. But I just applied anyway, and I was in Florida, so I wanted to go to Florida because they had a good reputation for aquatics, and it was also in-state tuition. So luckily, I got in. I got into the University of Florida. I graduated in 2010 with an aquatic certificate and an international certificate, and then I did a small animal rotating internship outside of Chicago to learn good, solid medicine from a lot of different specialists. That was a very challenging year, but made me a better doctor for sure. And then I got an internship at the Georgia Aquarium, which was supposed to last 1 year. And I ended up staying for 8 years and becoming the senior associate vet.
Oh, wow.
And then when this aquarium was opening, I got approached to see if I would be interested in heading up the vet program here. And I said, yes. And a few things got delayed and I had 2 kids. And then finally it all came together and I moved down here in 2019 to start this program.
Nice. Very cool. And what is the program like here?
It's very small. Okay. We have a small vet program, but I like to say we're small but mighty. Mm-hmm. So we have myself, another veterinarian, and 1 technician.
Okay. And actually, for a facility this size, that's not half bad. A lot of places I see have 1 vet. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. The challenges here are we have dolphins, which take up a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of care. And especially during hurricanes, like, one of us will always have to go with the dolphins if we have to evacuate them. And then we also kind of got thrown into doing sea turtle rehabilitation really soon after we opened because during the year of COVID, there happened to be a very large cold stranding event in the Northeast, and facilities up there were totally overwhelmed and, you know, lacking resources because of COVID, lacking people. And they called me because they thought I was still at Georgia to see if I would take some turtles. And I was like, well, I'm not there anymore, but I can tell you who to call there. And then I actually talked to Kurt and I was like, we have space at our offsite facility. He's like, if we can take them, we can take them. So our first year, I mean, we opened in August and we took 25 sea turtles in November.
Oh my goodness. That's so amazing.
Like we go pretty hard.
Yeah. I would say that's true.
Yeah.
I love I love sea turtles. Yeah. It is a well-known thing. We've already talked about this.
Right.
I really need to get out of the habit of just whipping my sleeve up and showing off my tattoo. I do it all the time now, but I really like it. But I I still, to this day, after being a huge fan of the Cold Stranding stuff, you know, the rehab stuff for years, and now this is the start of the fourth year of this podcast, I still will read articles and stuff about Cold Stranding stuff and, like, get emotional. Like, you're talking about it and I'm getting emotional. The idea of saving all of those turtles and all these facilities coming together. And like you said, like, it was a bad year in the Northeast this year. I talked about that on my Zoo News episodes.
Yeah.
This ain't the Northeast.
Nope.
But, you know, there are people who are willing to pay to fly the turtles, and then y'all are doing the work. It just touches my heart so much, especially because they're sea turtles. They're not cute. That's not true. They are cute,
really,
to me.
Cute.
But they're not a cute and cuddly species. Right. They're not the most charismatic species, you know. Everything else that is my favorite species is very cuddly looking, whether they are or not.
And, you know, one of the biggest things is to support these animals. You have so many of these small little mom and pop type institutional places that help, that are just funded by handouts. And during COVID, a lot of these places were shut down, which was another need for the Northeast to find other facilities to take animals, because there just weren't enough places that were open. And so when they called us and they said, you know, we said we could do it, they were like, thank God, because we need help. And all of the people, the volunteers that come together to help, you know, you talk about flying around. Turtles Fly Too is a great organization that flies, you know, and Alexa's on their board now. And,
oh, nice.
You know, it's just great people around. And it's not just in turtle areas, because these people are flying out of all over the country to help. And it's just a really cool group. The turtle group is pretty interesting when you put turtle people together, but they're so passionate about saving these animals.
We're lucky also because the Kim Stridley sea turtle are the ones that tend to cold stun in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. And they are found here in the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay.
So we're able to release them here right off our beaches, and we're able to let the public come see these releases, and aquarium visitors come to see the releases. And even the people from here may have never seen a sea turtle because the water is not crystal blue. It's Mississippi, Mississippi water. So that may be the first time they've ever seen this species, but it's in their own backyard. And so we have the chance to save the turtles and also teach people about them and why it's important to save them.
That's awesome.
Thankfully, we don't have to go back to the Northeast to let them
go. Right. Yeah. No,
that would be another level of complication.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. No, that's really cool. I've been on a slow, like, as the podcast goes, there are obviously a million different things to talk about and address, but I've been on this kind of slow journey with it where, you know, first I talked to some aquariums that have sea turtles, and then I went with Moat Marine and got to be part of the checking out the nests and, you know, spiking the nests and seeing what turtle eggs look like in person. And then when I was out in LA, there is a juvenile colony of sea turtles that live in a river, just the edge of the river that goes into from the ocean. So it's less salty than you'd expect. It's a very weird thing. I'll send you a link to my episode about it. But I got to see and watch these juvenile sea turtles in the river and this like weird special thing. And then at some point I'm desperate to get to like a release, and I would love to do it from like the facility watching it happen. You know, I know there are permits and stuff. You have to stay back, but just to share it with my guests.
You can come to one of our releases.
I would love to do that. Getting back to Mississippi is always, that's the part. Yeah. It's always the tricky part.
Yeah.
They time out. But at some point it's gonna happen, because I'm obsessed, and I will cry. I will absolutely
anytime
cry.
We usually start releasing them in, well, we actually have one left, and so I don't know how long it'll be around, but it's about to be released.
Oh my gosh. I leave tomorrow morning.
Okay, maybe not tomorrow, but then next year it will probably be around like March is usually when the first one is.
Well, good March news. Is my birthday, so maybe that'll
there
be
you
my,
go.
My birthday.
Yeah, and it's emotional for people. We had one lady that did a release that went out the next day and got a turtle tattoo on her ankle because of how emotional it was.
I believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really special.
Yeah.
So awesome. Well, thank you for sharing all of your story. And I know if you haven't figured this out yet, I just run with this, so we go off on tangents. But so what is your story?
My story. I grew up outside of Chicago. And my freshman year of college, I thought I was going to be an architect. And I thought, well, that's silly. So I switched and went down to Purdue University and was a hotel and restaurant degree. I went to that and got my Bachelor of Science in Hotel Restaurant Institutional Management with an emphasis on business. Started working with Hyatt Hotels in Chicago in the mid-80s. In 89, I moved out to California, to Monterey, California, and I worked for a resort there. I was there 11 years, went to a resort on the Big Island of Hawaii for 2 years. Went through 9/11 in the Big Island of Hawaii, which was a difficult time. Being in the hotel and resort world in the islands, it was a lot different than if you were in that business on the mainland. Businesses could get back up and running because people could drive to your resort if you were in California or Florida or wherever. But in Hawaii, everybody has to fly in. And right. nobody was flying after 9/11. It took a long time for people to get comfortable flying again. And so we went through some hard times in Hawaii. And I saw an ad in the newspaper to be the general manager of a place called Dolphin Quest on the Big Island. I knew nothing about dolphins, but I wanted to move my career into a point where I could run a business for myself. And this was an opportunity. So I kind of knew what they did. You know, they did some swimming with dolphins, but I really didn't know what they did. And so I went and did the interview, made a fool out of myself, but eventually talked my way into the job. And what I really learned was they had continually kind of had different people running the facility. A lot of animal people kind of got brought up, and they really needed somebody to focus on the business. And I knew the hotel business because I had worked in the hotel business for so long. So I knew how to interact with a hotel, and then I could learn the business. And so having a dolphin program in Hawaii, we did about 150 swims a day with the dolphins at the Hilton Waikoloa Village. And when I broke down the business, because my friends were like, you're crazy. Like, you were working at the best resorts in the world and now you're doing this. I said, well, if I fail, I can always get a job in the hotel business because I'm right. good at it. There's right. millions of hotel jobs, but this may carve me into something else. 150 swims a day is no different than a 150 room hotel. It's a perishable product that you have to sell today that you can't sell tomorrow for today. And so I knew who's going to swim with dolphins. Tourists in Hawaii, well, they stay in hotels. So I kind of knew the business of trying to sell a perishable product to tourists in Hawaii. And from there, you just evolve on your business skills and kind of learn the entire business. And did that for 3 years. And my wife got pregnant. We decided we weren't going to raise our kids in the islands. We were going to come back to closer to family. So we moved to Chicago and I did consulting for a hotel. I got recruited out to California for two hotels there. And then the dolphin people called me back, pulled me back in. I feel like the godfathers, they pulled me back in. But I ran a facility in Florida called Marineland, just south of St. Augustine, for about 9 years. And during that time, it was bought by Georgia Aquarium. And the first CEO for Mississippi Aquarium and who did a lot of the consulting before construction was the ex-CEO of Georgia Aquarium. So he called me and said, hey, do you want to help on this project? And I said, sure. And so I came over and as COO, and then halfway through construction, I took over as CEO. So hotels, aquatics, when I look at it all as business, it's all hospitality. And, you know, how do you drive top line revenue, control your expenses? So I'm kind of the business guy. I don't have an animal background, but I will say being in the industry, I'm very curious and I ask a ton of questions. And I've learned more in this industry than any time in my entire life. And the doc over here calls me another vet tech because I'm willing to get my hands dirty and do whatever it takes to help the animals. And, you know, so it's been a fun ride.
That's really cool. I think I have been figuring out what my world looks like in this world. Cause like when I started the podcast, it was a pandemic project, and like I wanted it to be cool and I wanted it to be successful. And I didn't expect it to become what it has become. And now as I've become more passionate about it, I'm trying to figure out, you know, do I even step away from my primary career of drumming and do more in the conservation world and the, you know, I think storytelling is an important part of it. Mm-hmm. But it's very tricky to figure out your own path. And it's really cool to hear that you kind of figured out your own path and came here from an unexpected place. That's very cool to me to hear that. I struggle with that a little bit sometimes.
You know, and you look back and you take risks throughout your life. And that was a huge risk for me, is jumping out of an industry I had worked in for a long time and going completely different. And you never know what you're going to find. And, you know, within 9 months of being at Dolphin Quest in Hawaii, I was in Washington, D.C., walking the halls of the Senate building, talking to senators about policies to protect our industry, protect animals, and do a lot of different things. And, you know, those are things I would have done if I stayed on the hotel side of things. And so it really did open my eyes to a whole new world and experiences. And, you know, and you know, sometimes you got to take that risk. You got to look at you know, what happens if it doesn't work out? And I was pretty comfortable that I could work it out. So I took it and I'm happy I did, you know, and I've bounced back and forth between two different types of careers, but it's been a fun one.
That's awesome. And I think, I guess it's important for us all to kind of remember that, like, I feel like we do such a good job of defining ourselves, like, with words, very specific words. And you don't really have to. Like, were you a hotel manager? Or were you just that, like, you were you and you had this skill set and you could apply it to hotels and then you could apply it to an aquarium and you learned other stuff. You know, when I started this podcast, I was a total outsider. I didn't know, you know, what half the terms meant. And now when I talk to people, you know, at a facility, someone will ask a question. There's no staff around. I'll step up with the answer because I usually know it. And now I have to be careful to not be all jargony. And it's like, you really can learn this stuff. And it's like, sometimes I feel like, yeah, just in my own world, I know I get hung up on like, I'm a touring drummer. What can I do in the conservation world? But no, I'm me and I can do stuff. And like, yeah, I love that you're not just doing that side of it. Like you said, you'll get your hands dirty, that kind of thing, you know? The other day I was at a zoo. And I was interviewing their penguin keeper and she was like, all right, you're going to help me feed the penguins. And I was like, cool, cool, cool. And I mean, a lot of times people use that terminology and then I go and I meet the penguins and I'm there for the feeding, you know, very cute, right? Whatever. She hands me a checklist and was like, you got to be quick. I'm going to call out what they're eating. Here's how you do this. Because they were short a person that day. And I actually sat there and did the penguin feeding. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm working right now. That's cool. Like, yeah. And you just got to be willing to jump in.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
fun.
And yeah. I think at smaller places like this, it's a blessing and a curse at times because, like, I'm the vet, right? But I do so many other random things. And I mean, things that I would never think of doing. And then even when you're going to be a vet, you don't realize that you're also going to have to make sure that all the pesticides that are used are safe for animals. And you also have to approve, you know, everything that the trainers want to use to enrich their animals. You have to make sure that's safe. And then I worked on a photo safari scavenger hunt and I've been writing grants and working on exhibits design and stuff. But I think that's what part makes it fun, right? It's challenging. You get to learn new skills, all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. No, that's
it's
very
called
cool.
life.
Yeah, it is. It's a life. You're right. And I think very much that once Zoe is in at a zoo or an aquarium, I'm going to probably be there in some capacity.
Yeah.
And whether it's as a volunteer or working, I'll figure it out. But, you know, it's fun when you carve your own path.
Though, it is.
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, I'm sitting here right now. I'm playing a show that I wrote at the casino down the road. And I'm here interviewing y'all for a podcast that I created. None of this existed. And sometimes it's like, I have to step back and be like, no, you're doing the thing. And then other times it's like, I don't know, you just want more, you know? That's like you said, that's just life.
Yeah.
But let's talk about some of the animals here.
Okay.
Because y'all have a wonderful collection. And one of the things that I noticed as I went through the facility is that the animals and the exhibits are amazing, like hand in hand. Sometimes you go to places and there's a really cool collection and the exhibits are fine, like obviously fine, wouldn't be on my podcast if they weren't, but not like extra special. And then other times you go to a place that's like really awesome and then the animals are, you know, pretty standard. Here I feel like it's a really good mix, again, probably because it's a newer facility, but what would you say are some of the fan favorites here? And like what I want to hear about really is the animals, but also the juxtaposition with what makes the exhibit so cool.
Okay. So I think that, let me just put dolphins out there because they're a fan favorite for a lot of people. We have one of our members who comes with his mom every day and knows how to identify the dolphins.
Amazing.
And the dolphins interact with him as well. So
he likes playing harmonica to him.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's really cool.
It's a really cool thing. Yeah. I don't know if you ever saw a viral video of someone playing a drum with an elephant and then the elephant drum. That was me.
Really?
And yeah, it has over 300 million views. And it's like this super viral thing was up at Buttonwood Park Zoo.
Nice.
What a way to connect with animals through music.
Yeah.
It's enriching for people and for the animals, mm-hmm. right? So yeah.
That's so cool.
I think that the dolphins, you know, lend themselves to people falling in love with the actual individual animal.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
when I got here, immediately one of the dolphins swam up to me.
Yeah.
And I don't know which one, but I was like, hi, I love you forever. Like literally we were face to face and I was like, all right, cool. I'm sold on this place.
Yeah.
One of the things that is kind of new to us are the beavers. I don't know if you saw them very much, but they're one of my personal favorites. One, because as a vet who works with a lot of exotic animals, I've never worked with a beaver
nice.
until until here, and they're so cool and they're so weird. I mean, they have cloacas, which is weird for a mammal.
Yes.
And they're just so cute and like so cool. So it's been really, really interesting and awesome to see the trainers start to work with them. They each have their own little log station that they come to eat, and they're so cute, and they sleep on their backs and they look like they're just passed out like from a hard night. So I think, I don't know if they're a fan favorite, but they're definitely one of my favorites.
They're a John favorite. When I got here and saw that there were beavers, somehow I missed it. Like I said, I did a lot of research on the facility. Beavers,
well, they're new.
Beavers came in at the end of March, I think it was. Okay. And so we had that habitat was a crocodile, and the crocodile went back to Orlando to be studded out, basically. They were going to breed him for baby crocodiles. And so we had that empty exhibit, and we had access to 3 hand-raised beavers. And then not a lot of people get to see beavers.
No.
Because in Mississippi, they're a nuisance animal. And so if you have a beaver on your property, most of the time, unfortunately, they get shot or something. And so to be able to educate people that come through that think they're just a nuisance, but they really aren't, is really cool. And to have, you know, nobody believes you can just put your hand out and have a beaver eat off your hand because they think those teeth are going to rip you to shreds.
Right.
And to see these little beavers eat, like, they kind of like are little raccoons, you know, they're really, really cool.
They're
and so
super cool.
The first day we had them in, we had a school group come in. And the whole school group comes in, beavers, and they stop for like 20 minutes just to look at the beavers. So we kind of knew it was something that people might like. So
yeah, I was a big proponent of the beavers.
Nice. They really are cool.
What do you have to do to like with the exhibit to like get it prepped for them and everything? Because they're like a weird little animal.
The biggest thing is if you think about their teeth, right? Like they literally chewed on trees. So the exhibit was wood, and we actually got a sponsorship from what was the company's name? Complete Exteriors.
Complete Exteriors, who does gutters.
Okay.
So they donated flashing that we could paint that looked like wood, but we could protect the wood from the beavers.
That's so cool.
And so that was, I mean, building their little lodge and making sure they have good temperature control. And then wood proofing basically was like the big,
the rest of it was kind of challenge. In place. It was kind of an easy transition.
Nice.
Yeah. Cause the pool of water was already there for the crocodile and things. Yeah.
Right. So
it was relatively easy, but it was wood protection.
That's really funny. And what are their names?
Do we have Elvis, King, and BB?
Yes. I love it so much.
Yeah. So the Beaver Brothers, they are the Beaver Brothers. And we really wanted to go back to the roots of music in Mississippi and really tie it back because we are the state's aquarium. And so, you know, anytime we can tie back to the roots of our state, we want to. And so Elvis, BB, and King are the Beaver Brothers.
Yes. Yeah. I love that
live
so much.
And on stage.
Love it so much. The music that I tour the most is rockabilly. Tonight, I will be playing Elvis music when I'm at. Like, my show has Elvis, you know, as part of it.
Awesome.
So,
awesome.
Yeah. So
well,
that's,
then you're in the good state.
Yep, exactly. Oh, yeah. No, the first time I played Tupelo doing that stuff, it was insane.
I think our...
In Tupelo.
Yeah, no,
right. Doing an Elvis. I mean, come on.
I think our other animals that... I mean, okay, so I'm very biased, right? But I have a lot of favorites. But I mean, our big exhibit, our oceans exhibit with all the fish and the sharks and the rays, collectively is really awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have a few highlight animals in there, which I would say would be Banner, our green sea turtle. She was hit by a boat and is positively buoyant in her rear, so she can't be released. So
positively buoyant is the most PC way of saying bubble butt I've ever heard, just for the record.
Yeah, she's a floaty. And so people love her, and she's very charismatic. And then we have a zebra shark that is really beautiful. She's pretty much all white, and that's a leucistic variation of zebra shark. A lot of people haven't seen zebra sharks because they're native to Australia, that area. And then personal favorite, I got a shout out for the stingrays. They're so cute, especially our little spotted eagle ray that's new to us, and all the rays in the little touch pool. But I think a lot of people really like seeing those rays up close and the sharks up close. And I have a lot of questions about how the sharks don't eat the other fish and things
like
that.
Right. So I want you to answer that question first, but then after you answer that, remind me that we need to talk about the design of that exhibit.
Okay.
Because it's insane in the best way. But yeah, so for people listening, why do your sharks not eat, you know, other fish and like keepers and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
The aquarists.
So the aquarists do a really great job. As you can imagine, if you're taking care of an animal, much like you want to know if your dog eats its breakfast and dinner every day, you have to watch it and measure it. So our bigger animals are all trained to come over to a station to eat, and we give them measured out food so that we can make sure their appetite is good. Because when an animal can't tell you how they're feeling, one of the biggest signs is, are they eating well? Right. And if they drop off, it means you need to look at them. So they're fed very well. They're fed like their body. We do calculations based on their body weight and kind of what kind of animal they are. So they should be satiated or full most of the time. Now, there are still wild animals, right? So I'm not going to say that no little fish ever get taken out, but we minimize it by making sure that they're well fed and station trained.
Yeah, makes sense.
Every diet for those types of fish is run through a nutritionist as well to make sure that we're feeding proper diets and nutrition. So it's pretty cool.
Nice. Very cool. Yeah. And so the thing that stood out to me about this exhibit the most, so for those of you listening, you know, it's fairly common at aquariums to have a giant tank with a tunnel that you get to walk through. And this is one of those. But there are two things that stood out to me. First of all, it's a true 360-degree tunnel, which you don't see a lot. Mm-hmm. It's becoming more common, which is awesome. But seeing stuff above, below, each side, wherever you look, is very cool. But what really stood out to me is that you can see the top of the tank. Most aquariums, that is a very expensive behind-the-scenes tour. And as soon as you walk into the building, it's the first thing you see. I stopped dead.
Yeah.
I was like, wait, you give this away for free?
I know.
And you have the touch tanks going along the side of it.
Yeah.
Not in it. You can't, like, reach in and touch a sea turtle.
Right.
But, you know, yeah. So what went into the – what's the thought process behind that?
Yeah, I think,
you know, we're proud of what we do, and being – you know, going through zoos and aquariums, you talk to a lot of employees, and I tell people this all the time, there is not a more passionate group of employees than people that work in zoos and aquariums or work with animals. Hands down, the most passionate people. And when you see that passion come through and how we care for animals, we're very, very proud of our professions and we're proud of what we do. And so the thought process was, we want to showcase that. And so we don't want to hide it. We don't want to have, you know, Oz behind the curtain on how we take care of things. So we want to show our guests what we do every single day, how we feed animals. We can talk about it because that creates that connection to the animals. And, you know, the pillars that we have that we've built our company on, our logo has three sails on it, and those sales represent education, conservation, and community. And so everything we do revolves around education, conservation, and community. And when we can talk to our guests about those things, that's what we want to do. And having that open on the top allows us to really showcase what we do every single day. And we think it's important.
I love it. And it's not just, you know, going ahead with what you were saying with the transparency stuff, which is my favorite word on this podcast. I think the biggest service that I provide to the industry right now is I'm an outsider who comes in, you open your doors to me, I talk to people, I get to go behind the scenes a lot of the time. I am external transparency. That is not bought and paid for. That is not, you know, and I think that's very important. I think transparency is very important. And up there, not only do you see the top of the exhibit, you see where the divers get ready and stuff. Like, not like the showers. They're not changing in front of people. It's not that kind of aquarium. But
we have doors.
Yeah, that's the actually expensive. That's the expensive behind the scenes stuff. But I love that literally not only was I looking at the animals, but I looked up and a diver had just gotten out and was just like there in the suit grabbing their gear. And I was like, heck yeah, this is awesome.
Yeah, and I think being transparent is critical for our industry because we are under attack every single day from people that don't think we do good things. Mm-hmm. And our industry tries to tell our stories the best we can. And we do get drowned out by organizations that raise a very lot of money every single year that have an axe to grind against us.
Yep.
And so anytime that we can make a connection with people to show how much we care for our animals, how our animals are cared for, is absolutely critical in the public perception because it's a tough road, especially when you have dolphins. It is a tough a tough thing to deal with when you start getting under attack. And, you know, we've got a great network of people around the country that have marine mammals and things. And we love what we do, and we love to showcase what we can do, because it really does make a difference in the conservation efforts. When people are connected to animals, they make a difference. And that's what we're here to do.
Yep, 100%. I mean, you know, I've told this that my listeners know, but I've gotten like death threats for doing this podcast. One was like scary enough and like pursued me enough that they got my number, they got my address, all that stuff, that I actually had to call the cops.
Oh my God.
I'm like, for doing a podcast about good facility. It's crazy. Crazy how it gets. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's interesting. But I hear you. I've experienced not nearly as much as y'all have, but I have experienced it. And it gets really, the things that have been said and, oh yeah, no, it's
and
nuts.
When you can pull the curtain back and actually show people, they're like, oh my God, I had no idea how well these animals are treated, or what you do, or how you do conservation in the wild. Because if you didn't have organizations like zoos and aquariums, there'd be a lot more problems out in the wild. And the employees that work for zoos and aquariums, if you put them together as the largest collection of conservationists in the world, and you've got, you know, the naysayers out there that think they're the conservationists that have never worked for an animal. You know, they're a lawyer, they're a lobbyist, and they think they know what's best for animals, and they have no clue. And so that conservation side is important for our industry to continue to tell the good stories about what we do. There's bad apples out there, and we'll call them out as fast as we can. But for the good ones that are out there that are doing all the good work, we should be shouting from the rooftops.
Yep, absolutely. And hey, that's what we're here doing.
That's right. That's exactly right. You
know, yeah, I love that. That's very real. So since you don't come from the animal world originally, what are your favorites here?
You know, we just opened our Changing Tides building that we added 23 new exhibits. And because we have new animals in there, I kind of like some of the new ones, but we added like a little rainforest area, and the poison dart frogs to me are some of the coolest looking animals. I mean, they are really, really awesome. The seahorses are really cool. Pipefish, some of the birds, the macaw, Todd's pretty cool.
His name's Todd.
Yeah.
Okay. Todd. He was my post on Insta today. as soon as I went in there, I started taking some pictures of Todd, and Todd came right up to me, and I was like, "Oh, are we best friends now?" Okay. I really like Todd.
Yeah.
Todd's cool.
You know, and the sloth and the armadillo. I mean, we just have such a unique collection. You know, we didn't even talk about the rest of the stuff outside. You know, we've got river otters, we've got alligators, we've got a walk-through bird aviary.
You really like the pheasants.
The pheasants in the aviary are some of the most beautiful birds in the world. I'll put it out there. They are awesome. The freshwater river has some really neat stuff. We've got a great collection of gar and snapping turtles. And
amazing terrapins in there, too.
Yeah.
They were so gorgeous. Yeah.
You know, so it's we say we're an aquarium, but we're kind of a hybrid of a lot of different things. And so we've got some really different animals. And that's what I think people are starting to really enjoy about our new exhibits, is seeing some different things. And the colors of the poison dart frogs, I think, are just phenomenal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you talked about the freshwater river that you have running through the outside of the aquarium, and it's an exhibit. But it's made to be like a true, like, this is what you would be like if you were in a, you know, freshwater area out here.
Yeah. Can that was the design. That was kind of the design, is as you walk in, it's kind of, you're walking on a boardwalk through Mississippi.
Yeah.
And so what are you going to see? You're going to see alligators. There's gators everywhere. We have beavers. We have otters, the freshwater fish. You got dolphins right offshore. And so it really is, being the state's aquarium, we wanted to highlight the animals that are native to the state. The bird collection's a little out of bounds with Mississippi. You don't see some of these birds. The Chinese pheasants don't show up in Mississippi on a migration pattern. But birds, we wanted to showcase really neat birds, colors and shapes and things. And so that's what, you know, we went out to do multi-species and things, but we really wanted to showcase. And our tagline when we first opened was "From Brown to Blue and Beyond." And so we talk a little bit about the brown waters of Mississippi that turned to blue and beyond. And so that was kind of the theming of how we came up with what animals were coming in and part of the design.
I like that a lot. From brown to blue and beyond.
And it's hard to make people like, it's hard to satisfy everyone, obviously, so that our guests, many of them want to see more native animals to Mississippi. And then some of them are like, I don't want to see that. I can see that every day. I want to see some crazy animal that I wouldn't be able to normally see. So I think that, and You know, I used to be more of a purist. Like, I only want to see native regional animals, but then I had kids and they just want to see cool stuff. Right. So they want to see cool, flashy things,
color,
cool fish,
color, size,
dart frogs, yeah, things like that. So I think we've done ourselves a favor by kind of offering a little bit of everything.
No, absolutely. Yeah. That's very cool. Yeah. We are running towards the end of our time here. And so I absolutely have to ask about, it's my job as a John Rossi to ask you about the sea turtles. We already talked about one a little bit, but I know you have three here and I need to know all about them.
Okay. So we actually have two permanent residents.
Okay. Okay.
One is Banner. She was the one that got hit by a boat, rehabilitated, and we are her forever home now.
Right. And she's a green sea turtle,
She's a green sea turtle. She floats. So we actually have little stickers with her picture on that say bottoms up that people can buy. And then our next one is Clementine, and she's a 43-year-old Kemp's Ridley sea turtle.
Incredible story.
So yeah, she was part of a breeding effort of Kemp's Ridley turtles that were taken down to the Cayman Islands in the 80s.
Okay.
And she lived in the Cayman Islands for a very long time. And then NOAA and U.S. Fish and Wildlife decided it was time to bring the turtles back for various reasons. And they had 10 of these turtles that they needed to place. And so we had to submit an application and many, many questionnaires to make sure that we could properly care for the turtle and give her a forever home. And we had to make sure Banner was indeed a female so that we had two females and not interbreeding.
Yeah. Right, right.
So she is really funny because she pretty much likes to sleep and eat, and while Banner's like more all about the facility. So you'll always see Clementine down in the corner. Like, that's her place.
And Clementine,
that's
where I saw her.
And when she was born and taken to the Cayman Islands, she was there for a breeder. She was a breeder. So she never experienced very deep exhibits, other fish, like nothing. Like, she was a breeder to try to reestablish. It was a Head Start program, they called it. When they canceled the Head Start program, Fish and Wildlife and everybody says, we need to repatriate these animals. Yeah. And that was the effort to bring them back. So when she first got into the habitat, she kind of didn't know what to do. Like, she had never seen 30 feet of water.
Yeah, she froze. She
was, oh, wow.
Like she went over the
edge. She'd never seen fish like that, you know? Wow. So it was kind of interesting to watch her acclimate into the habitat. But to be able to repatriate and be one of only 8 facilities in the country to get one of those animals was really special for us.
And she comes over to a station to eat, so we're able to make sure she's eating what she needs to. And both of them are station trained. And then our third turtle that we have is actually not an exhibit because we only have one left in rehab, and it's a small Kemp's Ridley turtle that was having a long-term infection. It's like, I don't know, smaller than a dinner plate, I guess. Aww. And that little girl or guy, I don't know, will be released soon, probably within the next week or two.
Do you ever like name when you get the cold stunned or anything? You have your patient
names?
You
know what? So we should. Maybe next season we will, because right now we just use numbers.
Okay.
If we have so many, you know, but I think we'll work on something like that.
It's hard to come up with 50 names and try to keep them straight.
Yeah, no, I get that. But I think especially for longer term patients and stuff.
Yeah. We'll work on that.
Because we had
Fog and Typhoon.
Fog and Typhoon were long term care ones.
They were transferred from New England Aquarium to us.
Okay.
Because they needed some space and they needed someone to care for them, but they're released now. So yeah, currently we only have 2 permanent residents and 1 almost ready to leave just in time for more rehab.
And that rehabber's been here for a year.
Yeah.
Very, very cool.
Yeah.
And then let's talk conservation for a little bit. So y'all do conservation work here. What kind of conservation stuff do you have going on?
So the sea turtles, we've already talked about them.
That's a big one.
The vet staff is involved in numerous different organizations. I'm involved in the AZA Safe Shark and Ray.
Oh, nice. Very cool. Very cool.
Thing. I serve as a co-leader for the Blood Project. So Jill Arnold and I are compiling blood samples from all of the sharks and rays that we have in zoos and aquariums, but also wild. And we're going to make reference values so that researchers and veterinarians can understand what's normal and abnormal. So that's a really big conservation effort.
That's huge.
And then our associate vet, Dr. Sean Perry, is involved in a lot of turtle conservation. Like in Madagascar, there was a massive confiscation of tortoises a few years ago.
Yes, I remember.
He's part of that project.
So he goes down there and checks them out and makes sure they're healthy. That's like kind of separate. I mean, the two of us do a lot of extras.
Right. A lot of people in the industry do because you're passionate.
Our little pet projects.
Yeah.
And then we have recently, sharks and rays are actually my favorite passion. Like those are the things that really excite me. And we've been working on a lot of little projects because as a startup facility, we don't have a lot of money to put toward research. So we're kind of meshing it all together to do some shark research. And then our most recent thing, which we're really excited to be involved in, is we're going to start working on propagating deep water coral for restoration efforts in the Gulf of Mexico.
Nice. Very cool.
So we're really, really excited that we're in the very infancy of that, but we could probably do like a whole podcast on that, honestly.
We're partnering with NOAA on that, and it's going to be a really neat project. Well,
it's NOAA, USGS, it's everybody. It's
right.
National Marine Sanctuaries. Like, it's really big project.
That's very cool. Coral is so important.
Yeah.
And I'll do a little shout out to the doc too, because there's no case that we look at that we don't shy away from. And when we first opened, we had a shark that had basically scoliosis, and we did spinal surgery on a shark that had never been done before.
Wow.
We brought human surgeons in to help us, spinal surgeons. We put plates on a spine of a sand tiger shark, and actually we did it twice, and nobody had ever even considered doing it. You know, a lot of places won't go that extra mile because it's maybe just a fish or this or that, and sometimes it just gets euthanized. But we want to advance veterinary medicine. We want to help. And so we took the chance of putting a shark under anesthesia. The second time was almost 3 hours, and cutting it open, getting to the spine, putting screws in to hold plates. Nobody would ever think you could do that. And we did it successfully. And so, you know, kudos to the doc here for putting the team together to do it. And then we had lymphoma in a Kano's ray, and we did chemotherapy on a Kano's ray that had never been done before. So we're consulting with human doctors and oncologists. So it's those types of things that we kind of dig into because we're passionate about the animals. And again, we want to advance veterinary medicine and figure out how to help.
In a
little small way, as a small little aquarium that's just brand new, we've done a lot of remarkable things, and it's a testament to our crew that we have here.
Yeah, and we collaborate with people as much as possible because we feel like we're better together, mm-hmm. And we have a lot of connections from previous jobs or previous training programs or whatever. And it's really, really important to us to make sure that we work with our colleagues for the betterment of all the animals and the advancement of veterinary medicine.
That's awesome. If people want to help support your efforts, what can they do?
Yeah, you can visit our website.
MSAquarium.org.
MSAquarium.org. And you can actually buy stickers of the shark that he was talking about. Her name was Stella. We made a little cartoon. So it's a really cute little sticker, and proceeds will go to our conservation and research. And same with the banner sticker. That's also on there. Or you can just, you know, if you win the lottery and want to massively donate to us, we'll definitely take it.
But you can adopt an animal. You can do, you know, on the website, you can just donate. You know, the sea turtle effort that we do every year, you know, we've been open 3 years. We've done about 140, 130 sea turtle rehabs, and all of those take time, money, effort. And so any kind of support that people can give us, it's always welcome.
And you guys don't charge the turtles for that?
You know what? They get a lot of free health care.
A lot of really good health care.
That's awesome. And now it is time.
It's time now, don't you know? We've come to the end of the show. But there's one tale left to go. You're going to laugh and say, oh no. It's time for the Rossifari poop story.
Oh gosh, okay. Did you say you want it to be about poop or not?
Just whatever your grossest story is, really.
My grossest story. Mm-hmm. When I was a vet student, this is kind of gross and cool. We were on our farms rotation. So we had to go out to, you know, farms, as you call it. And we had to palpate cows, which that involves sticking your entire arm up a cow's rear end. And first you have to evacuate a lot of the poop so that you can actually feel what you're trying to feel. And I'm 5'1" and I'm at the perfect height for the diarrhea to just go inside my shirt. So That happened with my arm up the cow, feeling if it was pregnant, and I just had to let it happen. And simultaneously, I felt something sucking my thumb because it was the cow was pregnant. And the baby was so far along that it had a suckle reflex. So I had diarrhea down my coveralls, and my thumb was getting sucked through the bum.
That's a really good poop story. That's a really good one. Cool. All right. So I will get your other one in a moment. But
thumb sucking in utero is pretty unique.
That is one of the most unique ones I've had. It really is.
I think my eyes bugged out of my face, and my teacher totally knew what he was doing when he made me do that. Which
that is
was
amazing.
Fun. Yeah. Amazing. I mean, that was a long time ago, and I still remember it very vividly.
Nice. Let me thank you both for doing this. This has been an absolute blast. I've really appreciated this.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Oh, that was such a good day. I had such a good time. And then I went to my sound check and it was crazy and there were all kinds of issues. And the whole time, all I could think was, wow, I wish I was back at the aquarium. But the show went marvelously, as it does. But I have to admit, my favorite part of the whole day was my time spent at the Mississippi Aquarium. So yeah, I'm grateful for the whole team there, and everyone was so welcoming and so awesome, and it was just a really good time. So I'm also grateful to y'all for listening, and to my patrons, especially my Red Panda level patrons, including Dr. Larshank, Dr. Stephen Williamson, and Barbara Bennett. And you know, those three awesome people, as well as all of my other patrons, are going to be hearing a bonus little story from this interview right after they're done listening to this episode. You can too. So don't forget to hit up patreon.com/rawsafari. And don't forget about the contest. I'm going to keep plugging the contest because it's a good contest. Cool prizes. And also, like I said, we can help Red Pandas come to a new facility, which is absolutely incredible. So yay for all of that. And I will be talking to y'all on Friday for Zoo News. But until then, remember, the word credits backwards is Steiderk. The Rawsafari podcast is produced, hosted, and engineered by John Rossi. Editing and fact-checking by John and Dr. Zoe Rossi. Our theme song is Sevens by Nathan Burke, performed by Nathan and John. Interrupting John theme and additional voices by Taylor Isaac Gray. You can reach John directly on Instagram and Facebook at Rawsafari or by email at rawsafaripod@gmail.com. Rawsafari is part of the Daydreamer Media Network. Now, stop listening to me and go visit a zoo.